Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast on all things nanny state. In this episode, we discuss Rishi Sunak's vaping ban, the lunacy of the WHO, and Chris's campaign for an extra day of summer. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom, and hello, listeners.
Chris is in Panama for reasons that we'll discuss a little bit later on, but amazingly, his connection is better this time around than it usually is on the South Coast. Great to have you, Chris. We're also delighted to be joined today by one of Chris's colleagues from the Institute of Economic Affairs. That's Harrison Griffiths, the communications officer there. How are you doing, Harrison?
I'm very well, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. So we're going to talk today, first off, about disposable vapes, the disposable vapes ban. Harrison has actually been puffing on one as we've been setting up this podcast here today. Chris, we knew this was coming. It was part of this consultation, which has been wearing on for some time. It was clear that this was the direction of travel. But when it was finally announced last week, I think the kind of full scale of how miserable and ridiculous this policy is finally dawned on some people. So do you want to tell us a little bit about the ban, what it's going to entail, it looks like, and what your thoughts are?
You're right. They're just going to ban all disposable vapes. And two statistics I only recently learned, I think, are quite interesting. Firstly, there's 2.6 million adults using disposable vapes, which is a lot. And 87% of the e-cigarette market in the UK is disposables in terms of, you know, market share, money spent. That's not to say that 87% of the e-cigarettes used are disposable, because disposable is basically a less efficient way of vaping. But still, it's a lot of people using a lot of disposable vapes. And what are they going to do when they get banned? I mean, I just don't see you being able to wipe out 80% of the market just like that. We know from Australia, people carry on regardless. I'm in Panama, where e-cigarettes are totally banned. Like, you can't bring them in your hand luggage, even. And indeed, you can't vape or smoke hardly anywhere, theoretically. And yet, there's plenty of it going on. About 90% of the cigarette market here in Panama is illicit, and people just ignore the laws. I've even seen like billboard adverts for e-cigarettes, product that is totally illegal to possess, let alone sell it. So, yeah, it's not going to go well, is it? And a lot of people are going to be pissed off. And as is often the way with these things, even though it's been quite widely touted in the media, I suspect a lot of users won't realise it's been banned until too late. At which point, I don't know, it just seems like Rishi Sunak's trying to, you know, get his polling down to zero, you know, by annoying everybody he can possibly think of. You know, the tobacco prohibition sliding scale of age thing, you know, seems to be designed to annoy, you know, kind of principled libertarians or conservatives. And this is just going to annoy a very large number of mostly working class people.
It is incredible. And as you say, that point about how many adults actually vape and use disposable vapes is important, because it is worth remembering that this is brought in supposedly to clamp down on young people vaping. That was certainly his motivation. I think if you talk to people, they probably assume that he was just making it illegal for young people to vape, not realizing that that was already the case, the way in which that was being talked about. But Harrison, I know that you wrote a piece about this for The Critic, where you said that we've got to kind of retire the phrase slippery slope fallacy, because we're clearly on the slippery slope, maybe about halfway down it. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what your reaction to this ban was when it was finally properly announced?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was just really what I wrote, that the slippery slope is not only a very real thing, but in the UK, it's basically become a cliff. And it's so unbelievably predictable. By we, I say, you know, the civil libertarians of the world have been banging on about this stuff for years, and it's across all sectors of policy and life, basically. You know, I talked about how the 2007 indoor smoking ban precipitated all of this when it comes to people's lifestyle choices, you know, what they eat, what they smoke. But it's also in areas like free speech, where laws designed to counter some of the most pernicious forms of speech, I guess, are now weaponized against people who just happen to have dissenting political views regularly. And so, you know, this, whenever you make an argument that, well, if the government adopts this idea, if the government sets this precedent, who knows what comes next? You'll often be dismissed by these serious, sensible policy wonk types as, oh, engaging in the slippery slope fallacy. it's not a fallacy. When it comes to government, it's basically a fact. And that's why I think it's really important that those of us who oppose this, you know, it's been pointed out ad nauseum now by people whose job it seems to be to read opinion polls on everybody else's behalf, that these prohibitionist measures are actually quite popular. I don't deny that's true. But I think if we're going to try and turn the tide against this, we need to be making arguments a little bit more on principle, because when people like Chris, who are constantly writing excellent pieces of evidence-based research, you know, the government is not bound to make policy based on evidence, and the disposable vape ban is really a really, really clear demonstration of that. And so I think we need to, you know, try and create a culture again where it's well understood by policymakers and also by the general public that really what somebody else chooses to do with their own body is none of your business. And if you don't like it, you don't have to engage with it. But don't go setting the cops on everybody because you don't happen to like their lifestyle preferences.
And Chris, before you address your own failures in terms of turning the tide with your excellent evidence-based arguments, I just wanted to get a sense from you about, yes, we have seen so many of these kind of creeping prohibitions before. Is there anything new about this one insofar as we've spoken about, the issue supposedly here is children using vape products that they're already not supposed to buy. But as you pointed out, as many of us have pointed out, there are all kinds of activities that kids engage in. There are all kinds of products that they buy and consume that they shouldn't, but no one goes around banning them for all adults. You know, kids and teenagers continue to be able to procure alcohol still these days, yet no one's running around trying to work out which drinks they tend to purchase and banning them for absolutely everyone, even if they're north of 18. Is this something new, do you think, in terms of these sorts of bans and policies?
That's a very good question. And I've been racking my brain trying to think of a precedent for this, you know, for banning something completely just because kids are illegally getting their hands on it. I can't think of any. I mean, I suppose you could say, you know, obviously drugs are illegal, but I don't think they're illegal because kids get hold of them per se. They're illegal because the government has decided they're bad for everybody. There's a bit of this disposable panic is kind of similar to the Alcopops panic of the 1990s. And I guess there were people back then saying Alcopops should be banned, but there weren't many of them. And the Alcopops thing actually kind of just came and went, didn't it? You know, they were very popular for a while, but you don't really see them anymore. I guess WKD is still just about going. So I think this is a new thing, and it's obviously very dangerous because it means that, you know, logically, you end up with no products that are kind of age-restricted anymore. You just got to ban everything because kids inevitably will get their hands on it, you know? And at the moment, for all the hysteria about youth vaping, it's only about 3 or 4% of 11 to 17-year-olds are using a vape, anything like regularly. You only need to go back 10 years and there was a higher proportion of kids of that age group smoking, but no one was seriously talking about banning cigarettes, you know, and people talk about vaping as a gateway to smoking, which it isn't anyway. But even if it were, wouldn't you ban the thing that it's a gateway to rather than the thing that's supposedly a gateway? So none of it makes any sense. Now, of course, combined with the generational tobacco ban, Rishi is at least being consistent in this because he doesn't want his daughters to smoke. Let's be honest. I think that's what most of this is about. They're about 13 and 11, I think, his kids. And suddenly he says, right, no one who's under the age of 15 now will ever be allowed to smoke. And they're not going to be able to get disposables either, which they might be knocking around their secondary school. So he's kind of being consistent in saying we're going to ban cigarettes and tobacco and cigarette papers. And shisha and cigars and everything else. Yeah, I mean, there's a consistency there, but it's a very scary consistency because obviously if it's rolled out to other things, that means there's no more gambling, no more drinking, and all sorts of other stuff has to be banned because we essentially are going to base public policy around what children do illegally rather than maybe enforcing the laws in the first place, you know.
Does make a hell of a lot of sense. I mean, especially because what a sort of straight-edge, teetotal individual that Rishi Sunak is, there's something particularly cloying about it. But one thing that was interesting, or striking, I should say, is how much he sees this as part of a sort of legacy. I mean, that was certainly the case when he discussed the slow, phased-in tobacco ban, but even with this disposable vapes thing, it seems like the only people it seems to have pleased are some of the great and good who are just instinctually in favour of any of this nanny state stuff. But also it seems to have given him a warm feeling, Rishi Sunak, because finally he's got something to point to. You can't help but feel like a lot of this.
Well, there is that, but I'm increasingly of the view that actually everything Rishi Sunak does has to be of direct interest to him and his family. If you actually look at what he's doing, the guy is basically, he's on borrowed time, and I think he's just decided to live his best life and, you know, use however many months as prime minister to do the things that are interesting. Look at what he's done. So disposables and tobacco, we've already covered that. That's to protect his daughters, yeah. Basically. He's very interested in chess. So he put tens of millions of pounds into some chess thing, project. He's obsessed with mathematics. So he's going to force everybody to learn advanced maths to the age of 18. He grew up in a pharmacy, and his latest policy, which is actually quite a good one, is to give more power to pharmacists to basically make more money because they'll be allowed to do lots of things that GPs currently do. It all comes back to him. As somebody quipped on Twitter, the next thing will be he'll outlaw height restrictions at fairgrounds.
I'll be all in favour of that. That was a real problem for me until I was like, you know, good 14, 15, something like that. So I get behind that. I mean, just imagine if he was interested in housing, right?
I'm sure he's got many of them, to be fair.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Imagine if he was so keen for everybody else to, I don't know, maybe have a second home or career prospects in the United States. I mean, we could be looking at really, really strong growth prospects. But the many galling policy failures of this government across the economy, dealing with some of these big things like housing, like the tax burden, like the regulatory state, I can understand to some extent why they haven't been dealt with. Like, oh, the Conservatives are perhaps worried that, you know, attempting to liberalise planning laws will mean that their last loyal voter constituency abandons them. Fine. But if indeed Chris's theory is right, that it is true that Rishi knows he's on borrowed time and has decided to kind of just do the things he wants to do, that makes it even more galling. If he has accepted the electoral incentives are irrelevant because he knows he's going to lose, why isn't he doing anything about housing? Why is he trying to take a safer...
He's already got a house.
I mean, it
makes... His own immediate self-interest is what is...
It is just, it's absolutely ridiculous to me that, you know, when folks like me who are, you know, young people who aren't very successful finance bros have basically no prospect of owning their own home if they live in the Southeast, at least until they're 35. The Rishi's actually decided that he wants to make me smoke more cigarettes instead. Like, just on a personal level, I find that utterly barbaric, really.
But it is because it's easy, this stuff. I mean, it's a route to a legacy and to looking like you're doing something. But really, in the grand scheme of things, what are you going to do? Pass a law, toughen up the enforcement? I mean, it does feel like it is the last refuge of not just like the pointless politician, but the inept one as well. You know, you can't crack these difficult things like getting your party behind some kind of liberalisation of the planning laws, but you can just say, you know what, we're going to stop doing elf bars.
Everything in modern British politics is a diversionary technique. It's all a distraction. It's displacement activity. Every single time there's a difficult issue, you go on to something else. So the multiple failings of the NHS, you had the CEO of the NHS this week banging on about the Kit Kat breakfast cereal as if that was the source of all the problems in the NHS. You had this horrific murder of the trans girl. And the politicians are talking yet again about we need to regulate social media. None of these things have any connection to the problem. You know, it's just let's focus on something else.
And many of them, as with almost every problem, as I see it at least, has a government failure embedded at its heart and very rarely a market failure. So with housing, you're talking about this is purely the product of the government erecting, you know, very restrictive and inconsistent planning laws across the country. When you're talking about the gut-wrenching murder of Breonna Jay a few months ago, you've got a pupil who had been kicked out of school for poisoning another pupil and sent to a school with a bunch of non-violent kids and nobody was made aware of it. When you're talking about vaping, it's already illegal for under 18s to be buying these things and the law isn't being enforced. the government has created the problems, and it somehow decided that the rational course of action is to use the state to make it worse. Whether you're talking about restricting social media access for under 18s, whether you're talking about ridiculous demand subsidizing policies like Right to Buy, or you're talking about a ban on disposable vapes for the entire adult population, they just think, oh, it'll be fine, more law. At least then we can convince the media that we're doing something about it, when in fact it just makes the problem worse and casts our liberties asunder along with it.
And then let's not forget the Clapham attacker, which as Tom wrote in Spite this week, a massive failure of the state. This guy clearly should not have been in the country for various different reasons. And what's the conversation about amongst politicians? Microaggressions.
I'm surprised they didn't make it a Brexit thing. That would have been spectacular, you know.
Yeah.
But no, thoroughly depressing. But we move on. Chris, should we talk about why you're in Panama? Because I think maybe you mentioned it on the last episode, but I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're attending the 10th session of the Conference of the Parties to the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control.
Not as such, Tom. No, I'm not actually allowed in. Nobody's allowed in. I mean, literally no one apart from the delegates are allowed in. You can apply to be an observer, but every single person who applied to be an observer was told that they couldn't come. So I'm in a different hotel in Panama City where the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, a US think tank, is holding a sort of alternative conference in which we're being very pro-harm reduction and very pro-vaping and so on, because the WHO is extremely anti these things. And, just trying to, protest, I guess, in our own small way, and try and remind the WHO that there is a different point of view here. They're going in a terribly, terribly wrong direction, the WHO. And I know in Britain, you know, probably most people don't really care what the WHO says, but they have an enormous influence around the world, and you've got more and more places. I mean, even bloody Britain now, banning e-cigarettes, at least in some form. I mean, incidentally, by the way, I think the reason that all this disposable vape ban stuff was announced last week was that so the delegates from the Department of Health could turn up at this conference and say, you know, we're no longer the holdout that you thought we were. We're now on side. We're clamping down on vaping. Plus, we're going to be the first country in the world to ban tobacco. So I doubt that was a coincidence. That's what's going on in Panama. They've got their big shindig. It's all totally secret. You won't be able to find out what's going on. You certainly won't be able to watch a live stream or turn up to see it yourself, which is pretty scandalous, really, when you consider we're paying for this thing. It's a United Nations conference. If you compare it to the environmental, you know, climate change COBs, which I'm obviously not a great fan of, but at least they are inclusive. I mean, even BP can turn up to the COBs to talk about how they want to be part of the transition. This is completely different. I mean, there are NGOs in there, but they're all fanatical anti-smoking, anti-vaping NGOs. And by the end of it, the word on the street seems to be that they're going to be making a sort of their official line on vaping will be tougher than ever, strongly recommending countries ban vaping outright. And they're also, interestingly, looking at maybe banning cigarette filters, which would be fine with me, because I think filterless cigarettes are fantastic. And the rubbish you get these days is all thanks to the filters. But it does make it impossible to control tar yields and nicotine yields. So it's effectively a form of prohibition, because if you say you're not allowed to use filters and you're not allowed to have more than this much tar, it's like, well, we can't do that. Okay, well, I guess you can't sell cigarettes anymore then.
When we have spoken about the WHO on this podcast, I've always been struck by like two things at the same time. One of which is that they seem obsessed with things that they really shouldn't be so preoccupied by at the cost of the issues that you think they should be working on. So this obsession with tobacco control, this obsession with vaping. Meanwhile, pandemic planning doesn't seem to have been fantastic over recent years. But also, Chris, this kind of willingness to kowtow to dictators. Like, I was looking back over some of the things we'd published about this. So Dr. Tedros, obviously, he applauded China's response to COVID, which, as we all know, was wonderful on all kinds of different levels. His predecessor, I think, praised North Korea for low rates of obesity. And she was the one, this was Margaret Chan, who in 2014, when Ebola was like raging across Africa, she ducked a conference on Ebola, if I remember correctly, to go to Moscow to talk to Vladimir Putin about e-cigarettes. And my favourite one, which was about 5 or 6 years ago, where the World Health Organization, whilst the situation in Syria was still terrible and, you know, Islamic State was still around, they put out a statement expressing concern about smoking rates in Syria, which I thought was very, very funny. So what should we make of this strange combination of sort of fiddling while Rome burns, but also any opportunity to just lavish praise on some of the dodgiest people in world politics? They'll take it up like that.
Sorry, can I just interrupt that for a second just to make sure I heard that correctly? A senior WHO official congratulated North Korea on obesity reduction.
Oh, yeah.
Is that serious?
Yeah, she said she was pleased to see how few obese people there were there, and also the North Korean health service is apparently very good, in her opinion. Look, Tom, it's more displacement activity, isn't it, really? You know, I mean, the WHO is there to deal with infectious diseases, track them, and it failed to do that very well, obviously, with COVID, but also with Zika and Ebola and various other things.
Yeah.
So it would rather grandstand about issues like vaping and sugar taxes and minimum pricing for alcohol. You know, same old story. Why do they applaud dictators so much? Basically, because dictators will tend to implement WHO policies more readily than civilized societies, because WHO policies are pretty fascist and authoritarian. So you do need a strong man to implement them, as I presume has happened here in Panama, where, as I say, everything seems to be illegal and everyone keeps doing them.
Well, and what do you make of all this, Paris?
Well, I think Chris just touched on a very important point that really links all this together. It's that, you know, the WHO may well be full of very learned, esteemed medical research academics, experts, if you will. But in a lot of cases, their expertise is only one side of a growing debate. There is no such thing as the science. It's a method. Your theory is only as good as until somebody disproves it. But the bigger problem that the experts, so to speak, lost as I am to kind of lump them all in together, but the experts are, as you would expect, very concerned with questions of is. Like, is smoking bad for you? Obviously, the answer is yes. They never consider ought. And this came out, I saw on Twitter yesterday, I can't remember who it was who tweeted it, but it was one of these public health nanny state experts who talks about, if she was responding to something that I think Liz Truss said at PopCon or something, I really hate it when people talk about the nanny state. It shows that they're obsessed with ideology over evidence. And to which there are two appropriate responses, both of which are actually two people beat me to it, both from the Adam Smith Institute. One is, when it comes to vaping, you are very clearly on the wrong side of the evidence that exists at the moment. And the second one is, that's only one side of the equation. Just because something is bad for you, even in some cases very bad for you, can you tell me what justifies the authority to stop you from doing it? And that question is much more difficult for them to answer. That question, to me, cannot be answered. But the most concerning thing is that they can't answer it. And this is why, of course, they praise tyrants, because tyrants don't care about aught either. They only have a singular goal in mind. And if that's COVID reduction in China, well, exactly, we've seen the consequences of that, haven't we? It was an absurd parody of dystopia for about 2 years, far longer than the rest of the world was even trying COVID control. So I think that's absolutely right. And the expertise has always been the alibi of the tyrant. So, it's completely sums up the public health mission creep, really, and the ideas that lay behind it.
Absolutely. Chris, not to make this episode all about you, but before we go to the postbag, I just wondered if you wanted to use this soapbox to discuss your current campaign. Many people might have noticed that we're in a leap year this year, and they might have also wondered to themselves over the years why that extra day that we get in a leap year is in miserable February rather than a month that's a bit nicer, a bit warmer, sort of time that you can actually enjoy it. But you have taken it upon yourself to launch a campaign calling for the leap day to be moved, and you've actually got a fair bit of pickup for it. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you've been up to?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had exactly that thought, Tom, and then acted on it by suggesting that we move the leap day from February the 29th, which, as you say, is generally going to be cold, certainly much colder than June. I've got plenty of evidence to show you that, on average, days are much hotter in the middle of summer than they are in February. And, stick it on the end of June. It's such an obviously good idea that no one has really been able to pick holes at it. There had been a few complaints from people whose birthday is February the 29th saying, what are they going to do? But this is not a new problem if you're born on February the 29th. I mean, 3 years out of four, you're going to have to move your birthday. So I don't see why you should really gripe about having to do it again. And, the Australians are obviously not very happy about it, but they've got a lot of hot days in Australia. I think it's only fair they share them around. I just love this idea because it's as much as you know that it doesn't really make any sense. Every time you think about it again, you go, actually, that does sound like it would be better somehow. And so I put a tweet out on a Sunday evening along with a change.org petition. And it went mildly viral, not massively, but it got a bit of engagement. And then before I knew it, Richard Madeley was talking about it on Good Morning Britain. And he was genuinely impressed. He thought this was a fantastic idea. And then the guy who runs change.org sent me an email saying, I like your petition. Do you mind if I share it with the media? It's the kind of thing that might take off. So I said, yeah, absolutely. So then this woman rang me up from some media agency and interviewed me. And she liked the idea as well. I said, well, how did it make you feel when you first heard about this? She goes, yeah, it sounds great. It sounds like it's going to be much better. I go, oh, yeah, I agree. So if it makes people feel better, then let's do it. And then she asked me to send her a couple of photos. So I obviously put them through FaceApp, gave myself a moustache. I found some particularly stupid photos as well. One of me with my guns out on a sunny day to emphasize how much I like summer, and one in a pub in Yorkshire with this dog sat on my lap. And they used both of those. That was good. And that then appeared in the Metro. Then people started writing into the Metro to say mostly what a good idea it was. There was a couple of naysayers saying it wouldn't really make any difference to the number of hot days, but they were in a minority. Somebody was saying this was a potential Brexit benefit and it should be in the manifesto of political parties. And that went out to various regional papers, and including in America, actually, thanks to bloody EU's GDPR, I couldn't see their stories. But it was all like dozens and dozens of local papers in, Texas and Hawaii and places about the man with the brilliant idea of making summer a bit longer. So it's been very successful. I've only had about 350 people sign the petition. But of course, for every person who signs a petition, there's bound to be lots who would agree with you if you knew about it. So if you assume that each person who signed represents a million people, that's like 350 million people supporting my petition, which is several times more than the population of Britain. So it's been phenomenally successful.
I was really disappointed to see some of the backlash to this, people labelling it an unserious idea. I think, For most people in this country, most good, hardworking people, having an extra day of summer is something they want. My birthday is at the end of June. I like to take a long weekend. It would enable me to take an even longer weekend every 4 years. I thought it was an excellent proposal. And I was disappointed by, as Chris says, some of the naysayers.
Well, hang on, Harrison. I don't want to pick holes in this at all. But how's it going to make the weekend longer?
Because there's an extra day in June. I'd take the.
Well, is it going to be a Saturday? We're going to have. I mean, I'm happy to.
What day of the week it's going to be? Is it going to be an extra Saturday, an extra Sunday? Like,
is it going to be a bank holiday? Well, I mean, that's workshop.
Well, no, but my policy has always been clear on this. I take my birthday's on the 26th. I take a long weekend until the end of June, and now that's going to be even longer. When I saw that petition, it was a real treat for me because I thought, oh goody, an extra day every 4 years or so.
Right, so it's a day off work rather than a 3-day weekend, I see.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Just for me personally. In all seriousness, though, it was one of the funniest things I have ever seen when it was featured on Good Morning Britain. You could see on live television the cogs turning in four people's heads live. I think, and it made complete sense, really. I think it was a good sort of, half-assed IQ test, where you had Kevin Maguire, Andrew Pearce, Susanna Reid and Richard Madeley on the panel. It was Kevin Maguire that got there first. You could see immediately. He was like, not sure about this one. And then it slowly went down the panel as they realized it. And just watching on live TV the cogs turning was absolutely hilarious. I think as Christian Niemitz, our colleague, has already said, I think this is probably your your best trolling yet.
Yeah, I may never top it. So you could see Susanna Reid initially really liked it, and then within about 20 seconds she turned against it. But Madeley never did. Madeley stuck to his guns and said he doesn't care whether it's actually going to change the weather. It's what things feel like that matters, and if it seems pleasanter, then we should do it.
voice of the people, absolute legend,
best prime minister this country never had.
We will follow and update on this campaign with interest, of course. Should we reach into the postbag?
Yes, please. Is it bulging?
It's always bulging.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
We've got here a compliment and a question from someone called Elon Mush, which I'm sure is their real name. So it said, there's a lot of good commentary bemoaning the relentless rise of the nanny state, last orders being preeminent, of course. Is there any way to go on the offensive and actually start dismantling the nanny state, e.g. what government departments, what quangos, what funding streams should be stopped? Chris?
Well, there is for the government. I mean, there's not much that we here at Last Orders can do about it, unfortunately. But this draining the swamp really is a thing. If you look at the organisations that are constantly promoting the endless nanny state merry-go-round, they are nearly all state-funded, and they can't raise money from the general public because the general public are not that bothered either way. So defund them, and it pretty much comes to an end. That's the single best thing that the government could do. And the fact that they haven't done it suggests to me that the government rather likes having these cheerleaders for health fascism.
Harrison, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think really it's a relatively straightforward, defunding these charities and lobby groups in receipt of taxpayer money to promote policies that would undermine those taxpayers' liberties even further is a very good start. Establishing very clearly what the mission of public health is from a government standpoint is absolutely vital, because all of this, really, the source of all of this is the mission creep of public health from, the guys that keep cholera out of the water and the people that are on hand in the event of some extraordinary pandemic, to people who are now primarily tasked with thinking up new ways to control the lives of consenting adults and what they can and can't do with their own bodies. So I think it's a very straightforward task, but of course, the not so straightforward bit is, are we ever going to get a government again that actually respects people's right to bodily autonomy, that actually understands that prohibition very rarely achieves its stated goals and creates enormous damage along the way? I don't know. I'm not particularly optimistic about it. Because once that ethos in a society is gone, it's very difficult to get back. And I'm not particularly optimistic about that. But I think as far as the policy program is concerned, if that government did get into power, it is straightforward. Restrict the funding and the mandate of public health, and a lot of the problem goes away.
You mentioned the water supply there. I just want to squeeze in one more question. Do you agree with the planned mandatory fluoridisation of the rest of England's tap water? And this is from an account called Fluoride Free Great Britain and Ireland. Chris?
I don't have a problem with it because there really are no negative consequences at all from doing this, and there are only benefits. So I wouldn't want them in. I wouldn't want this to be a slippery slope in which they start pumping all sorts of things into the water supply. But it has been done in various parts of the country and in many places in the world, and it doesn't seem to be an issue. We have in the past mandated sort of various fortifications of bread and things like this. And it's possible to imagine a slippery slope in which they start putting sedatives in it or something like that. But, it's not realistically going to happen. So I don't feel very strongly about it either way. It's not a substitute for brushing your teeth. So in a sense, it doesn't make that much difference, probably. And I don't think the evidence is it does make a strong difference to dental health. I don't think it's that strong. But I don't really care. And I don't think there's any downside to it.
I have to admit, based on my research, I don't know anything about fluoride. I don't particularly care. As I understand, it's pretty good for your teeth and doesn't really do much else to you. But what I do know is that I have once been down the rabbit hole of the anti-fluoride people on social media. And
I dare say that's where this question came from.
I mean, I couldn't possibly comment, but Fluoride Free Britain, maybe he's the sensible face of the movement. But it seemed to me as though a lot of their arguments revolved around humans having a third eye, and that there's a conspiracy by the government to use fluoride to numb that sense. Now, given that fluoride hasn't been, you know, put in water in a widespread manner in most places for most of human history, I don't really see the evidence of that. But it seems to be a very vibes-based analysis of the government putting things in water. And to be fair, you know, pretty much everything the government does, in my view, is bad and littered with bad incentives. But I think on this occasion, like, the slippery slope doesn't worry me too much, because I think the last thing the government was is its taxpayers being, you know, numbed or incapacitated in any way. Because, I mean, it does very clearly have an interest in, you know, keeping people, you know, working so they can pay tax. So I'm not too worried about that, to be honest. It's not at the top of my concerns.
I might stop brushing my teeth and see if my third eye opens.
Well, just wait. Keir Starmer's probably going to make you do it anyway.
Yes, indeed. The Yeah, well, this has got me thinking now, Harrison.
Well, it starts with the kids, Chris, but then, you know, as we know, it can be rolled out to the adult population in a flash.
Yeah, so the government wants to put fluoride in the water. Keir Starmer wants us to brush our teeth. It's all a bit suspicious, isn't it?
It is very suspicious. Well, listeners, join Chris in stopping brushing your teeth for a bit and let us know how you get on. But on that note, Chris, Harrison, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.